Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. This week, we leave the films over to you, our amazing Patreon supporters who have voted Anzio for this month's Patreon pick. You heard Matt at the start of the show there in the ident that we roll every week. If you want to get involved in the show and pick a film, Patreon's the way to do it. So stick with us as we wade up the water and onto the beachhead to attack this one head on. See what I did there, Matt?
Anzio. I see it. That was slick.
That was good. Yeah. It's almost like we're writers, isn't it? You know, it's almost like we do this.
140 episodes in and we're finally getting,
I know,
getting
right?
to the stride.
Right. Yeah. I can finally write some prose. Hooray. So, I mean, I'll start off with production this week. So the shooting of Anzio started in May 1967, and it was shot on location in Italy, in Anzio itself, Rome and Taranto. The shot of Rome filled with troops at the very end was at the time reported to be one of the biggest scenes ever shot in the city. And I've got to admit, that is a good scene. You don't see much of it, though. Blink and you'll miss it.
Yeah, I mean, that's great for them, but more on that later.
It's in there. Boy, it be a film. A co-Italian, I must
sure
actually
is.
Before we go on, I must say that this week's Patreon pick, Anzio, was one of my picks.
It was.
If anyone out there wants to go through the Patreon pick episodes, and that'd be a bit of a slog, but if anyone out there wants to do like a league table, because I want to see how many of my picks and Matt's picks have been chosen.
That's a good point, actually.
Have like a little league.
I feel like me throwing Hornblower in the ring for like
It might have tipped the balance.
I don't know if it was quite that long.
We need a Patreon pick league for the end of the year. We do something fun with it. If we knew,
you put 12 soldiers in, like
12 strong. Times, you know? Yeah, because I quite like
12
that.
Strong. That's it.
It's the only war film that I think has a Carhartt brand like advert in it. It's very odd.
Okay. Just because you're entering your Carhartt phase.
Yeah. Less
anyway,
about,
production.
Less said about my fashion, the better. So as I said, it's a co-Italian and American production with Dino De Laurentiis, his own studio, serving as a production company. He's a really famous producer. He was the film's producer on this one. And Columbia Pictures acted as its distributor overseas. And it's directed by the two-time Oscar-nominated Edward Dimitrik from The Caine Mutiny. You know, famous film. We need to do that one day. It's one of the best.
Yeah, totally.
Supposedly the film that Michael Caine took his Caine moniker from.
I heard that, yeah.
Apparently, yeah. Something about him going to do something and he he'd seen the Caine Mutiny on a billboard or something, and he went for that. That's a nice bit of trivia. But Dimitri himself also directed a couple more war films. He did Behind the Rising Sun in 1943, that also starred a very young Robert Ryan, and Back to Bataan, which is a John Wayne film, and The Young Lions in 1958. And he wrote about working on the film and his relationship with the producer and shooting the film in his 1978 memoir, It's a Hell of a Life, but Not a Bad Living. So this is one of his recollections. Then I was shooting a short scene in a landing craft. The soldiers were crammed inside, guns slung over their shoulders. I was about to turn the camera when I noticed that one of the guns resembled a pretzel. A closer inspection showed all our guns were made of rubber. I resorted to screaming again, a technique I'd relearned when I started shooting Anzio. I was told that Dino had an argument with our gun supplier and would refuse to meet his terms. I sat down in my chair and said I'd start shooting when we had proper weapons. Sometime after lunch, we were back at work. Still, there were days when we marched beyond to ships complete with tanks, troop carriers, and onlookers with the troops parading down the Via Dan San Giorgio through the Arch of Constantine and around the Colosseum, and later on the same day, marching around the Forum. All in all, it wasn't a bad show.
Maybe that explains why like the 40% of US soldiers in this film have SMLEs.
Yeah, it's an odd choice, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen so many.
Yeah. But then I read about those. There were some Americans that did use SMLEs for like once or twice. Is it a bit of jury's out on that one? Isn't it?
There's something on the internet that says, it when logistics required it. And I'm like, I don't know for any instances where that's happened. I have to go through some more for that one.
I've seen, and this, everyone's going to be like, oh, it's Osprey art. But I've seen an Osprey book with a guy with an SMLE number four. Great. Sorry, with a number four Lee Enfield. With an American arrow belt. I think he's the actual regiment that Falk is.
Falk's supposed to be. Yeah.
So that might, there might be something in there, maybe. Maybe the Canadian connection, they were supplied SMLEs. Yeah, okay.
Special services thing, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, back to the production. No, sidetracking early this week. Italian director Giulio Coletti also worked on the film. He's best known for 1954 Submarine Attack, which is an Italian production. He also produced a number of spaghetti war films, such as Full Gore Division in 1954 and Hell Raiders of the Deep in 1942 about Italian frogmen. There was some on-set tension, apparently, between Falk and Mitchum. George Segal was told by Peter Falk that he found it hard to confront Mitchum after receiving a tirade of anti-Semitic abuse from him. Not the first time I've heard Mitchum being a bit of a difficult person.
Yeah, Falk doesn't mention that in his actual memoir.
No, he doesn't, know either.
I
looked if Segal had said anything about it online. I couldn't find anything.
I wonder what the source is then, because I know that's on one or two film trivia sites.
Yeah, it's on IMDb. That's where I found it. So I went backwards. Because that's what annoys me with IMDb. You don't have to cite your source. It's just curated down, isn't it?
The eternal problem. We're historians, so we're like... That's damn not good enough, I'm afraid.
Where's your primary source?
We need some sources. That's interesting because Falk doesn't mention it in his biography. He dedicates a small chapter to the film. And most of it, he's talking about his interactions with the producer you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the interesting things about the film before we move on away from production, this probably fits in quite well.
I'm nearly finished with production. Nearly there.
So Falk initially got offered the role apparently before the script was completely finished, and he spoke to a writer and they gave him an outline of the part and he hated it.
Yeah.
So he said he turned it down, said no. Fast forward 6 months, he gets offered the role again, and he's promised that there's been a complete rewrite, the script is all, you know, been refreshed, been tweaked. So he agrees to do the role. At the behest of his agent. So he flies all the way to Rome, gets into his his hotel room, finds a script on the desk, picks it up, reads it, falls asleep hating it, wakes up the next morning, double checks, reads it again, still hates it.
Wow.
And he says, it wasn't interesting. The characters were all cliches. I fell asleep. The next morning, the first thing I checked was the script. My reaction, second time reading it, was the same as the first. My part was lousy, old hat, nothing to act.
My part was lousy, nothing to act. Wait a minute here. Wait a minute.
Just one more thing about this script, you know.
He literally did do that to Laurentiis. He just did one more thing.
He just had the script in his hand, walking out of that trailer or that hotel room. Just one more thing. You can't mention Peter Falk without mentioning Columbo. They're hand in hand, aren't they?
Exactly.
No, but it's really interesting, you know, how you apparently, and then apparently he rewrote a lot of his own dialogue.
Yep. So he had this massive interaction with De Laurentiis where he actually drove him to the airport because he came into his office, said, "I'm going home. My flight's at one." And Dino offered to like drive him to the airport. And while he was on the way, Dino was flicking through the script. All right, this is all Colin Falk.
Panicking.
Looking through the script, going like, yeah, we can change this. We can change that. And finally, he just turns around to Peter and says, "What do you actually want?" And
please don't get on that plane. Please.
Probably like he describes himself as like blurting out, "I'll write it myself." Amazing. He's like, "Do you want another writer?" And he's like, "I'll write it myself." And in his biography, he kind of like talks about this in a little bit more depth. He says, "I felt stalled and I wasn't sure if I'd ever break out of what I felt was an increasing rut. I'd been in films for nearly a decade and the parts were simply weren't coming the way I'd hoped. I was working steadily but creatively. But hardly creatively. I was on the verge of being typecast. Although not one to despair, I'd begun to have serious doubts about the direction I was heading. Those feelings, however, didn't last because along came the interesting part of a police lieutenant called Columbo. My life would never be the same again."
Love it. That's great.
Because it is literally the same year. So Columbo starts in 68 and runs all the way through to like 2002, whatever it was. It's
in
insane.
This film, all roads may lead to Rome. But for Falk, all roads led to Columbo. There you go.
Ooh.
Smooth.
Ooh,
this week.
You have that on your notes, Rob?
Off the dome, that one. That's a McGuire original. Off the dome. So getting back to production. Cinematographer was the Oscar-nominated and BAFTA-winning Giuseppe Rotolo, whose work includes 1959's On the Beach and 1961 The Best of Enemies, which stars David Niven. It's quite a good film, that one. Obviously, he did a lot more in his career. Won an Oscar for All That Jazz, and I think it's don't quote me, late '60s, early '70s. But we just, you know, we cover the war films on this show. Music by Oscar-nominated and Grammy-winning composer Riz Ortolani, known for his scores on westerns and horrors. Credits for war movies include The Seventh Dawn, 1964, which is a rare Malayan emergency flick. 1970s, The Mackenzie Break. And the George Peppard film from 1979 called From Hell to Victory. The film itself is actually based on a 1961 book called Anzio, written by British war correspondent Winford Vaughan Thomas, who spent the duration of the Anzio campaign there. I kind of wish the movie had kept him, or kept a version of him at least, as the main character and not made him American.
Yeah, I agree.
Kind of wish that.
Obviously, I haven't had a chance to read the book, so I don't know how far the film moves away from it, but I feel like it probably...
Well, that's the book's more of an overview of like what he did in the campaign itself. I feel like, as we'll talk about later, I feel like the film has a fair crack at it.
It tries to like hit the beats of the campaign, doesn't it? And try and explain some of the failings and stuff. But
in its own kind of way, yeah. It was released on July 24th, 1968 in the US and early August 1968 in the UK. It was actually called The Battle for Anzio here. Box office was 1.4 million, was unable to find a budget this week. Sometimes it happens. And the retro review this week comes from the New York Times, written by Vincent Carnaby from July 25th, 1968. And I've chopped it up a bit, but it's I think I have to read quite a long section for you to get how he felt. So the review headline is called Standard Warfare. And he goes on to say, "Anzio is a very ordinary war movie with an epic title. Produced by Dino De Laurentiis, the Italian producer who thinks big but often produces small. Once his troops have made their landings, the story narrows down to a standard one of a small patrol caught behind enemy lines. Completely ignored by the screenplay by Harry A. L. Craig, is a dramatization of the actual ordeal at Anzio, the bad weather that first delayed the landings and then the grounded air support planes, and the fierce attacks and counterattacks that dragged out for 4 months. As if to remedy this oversight, Robert Mitchum, as the journalist attached to Lost Patrol, at one point asks a peasant woman, 'Do you know what's happening at Anzio?' She doesn't. Mitchum, who even here walks as if he'd just got off a horse, is the most unlikely war correspondent since Lena Turner covered the Japanese invasion of the Philippines in Somewhere I'll Find You.
Okay.
He didn't like it.
He didn't, did he?
He later on went on to say that Dimitrix directing his one track, he was very scathing. He tails off.
Man after my own heart.
Hating it. But interesting. But on to the one word reviews before we get on to cast. And it was a mixed bag this week, very much like last week, I think. So Paul Woodage of World War II TV, we haven't heard from you for a while. Paul, he says, Mamma Mia. The Night Irish goes with Healy-less. Jem Dudaku goes with Bloated. Adam Hughes says Easy Watch. Two words, but, you know, makes sense. Our own historical firearms, Matthew Moss, says mid. That's a new slang word for something that's a bit mediocre. Lost in Translation goes with I Should Do a Rewatch. And then he also went with hashtag Falk. Brian Williams goes with Flawed. Ian McKellen says Parody. And round us off this week, Tim Selby goes with Snipers.
Yeah, pretty interesting field there. Some descriptive, some reactionary, I think.
Yeah. I think as well, there were a few I didn't read out, but it is very much like a you either like it or you don't.
Yeah.
It depends what you want from a film. I want a more from this, really. I think it's a bit middling.
So do I.
Which is kind of why I chose it, because it's interesting. You know, it's in a weird vein of war movies where it's about a campaign that doesn't get much love in terms of screen time.
Very true.
The most Italian war films you get are Italian-made productions in the 60s and 70s that are part of the spaghetti warfare genre. There's some great ones that stand out, like 4 Days in Naples or Rome Open City. Now, they spring to mind. But there's not really a one about the US Army's experience or the British's experience you can pin your hat on. There's Miracle at Santa Ana.
There's even a German-Italian one that's about the paratroopers in Monte Cassino.
Yes, that is quite good, actually. The sequences that are Monte Cassino, at least, are quite well done. Yeah, but there's Miracle at Santa Ana we talked about last week. Yeah. But there's actually a 60s series that was done as like a sort of sister show to Combat, which is called The Gallant Men, which is about the US in Italy. And that was devised by Robert Altman, actually, today.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's a war correspondent character in that that hits the beaches with the main cast. I watched a bit of it earlier. Looks quite good. You know, they do some nice stock footage cutting in and cutting out, which they didn't do in this. But anyway, that's getting off track again. But yeah, it's an interesting piece anyway. But maybe, Matt, you should tell us the cast before we go any further.
So just to round up the cast, there's a few, but the principal, you know, actors in this are we got Robert Mitchum and Peter Falk as the top of the bill. Mitchum plays Dick Ennis, a war correspondent, so that's a bit of a revisit of the story of G.I. Joe
in
a lot of ways, from 1945, where he obviously famously portrayed Ernie Pyle.
Mitchum didn't play Pyle, did he? Burgess Meredith. Sorry, I misheard you there.
No, sorry. I think the way I said it was a bit ambiguous.
I was like, hang on.
I was a bit ambiguous.
Chuffing the door of like film.
Sounded like I was saying that Ernie Pyle was played by Mitchum.
No, Mitchum's a sergeant in it. I forget the sergeant's name. But his only Oscar-nominated role, by the way.
Mitchum's good at playing that kind of role. And
oh yeah, brilliant.
I mean, we'll talk more about what he's like in this film later
on. But John Wayne in this it doesn't work.
There's something not quite clicking, is there?
Yeah, you want a war correspondent like the war correspondent out of Objective Burma. That guy. Mm. You want someone a little bit more aloof, a little bit more sort of not right. Mitchum looks like he could be playing a commanding officer or a grizzled sergeant in this. Like he doesn't come across as a war correspondent. I know some were gruff, but that worked for me. Sorry, Matt.
So let's just run through some of his prior war movie credits. We've got Aerial Gunner 1943, Corvette K225 in 43 as well, and Minesweeper in 43 as well. Mentioned a moment ago, Story of G.I. Joe, 1 Minute to Zero in 1952, Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, 1957, The Enemy Below, which we've covered on the show before, and we quite like Mitchum in that one.
Oh, he's great in 1957.
That. Yeah. The Hunters in 1958, Longest Day in 62, Midway in 76, Breakthrough in 79, and then he had those two miniseries, those big miniseries in the 80s, The Winds of War and Remembrance. And then, of course, mentioned earlier that the other top billing for the film is Peter Falk, mm-hmm. As Corporal Jack Rabinoff. He was in Attack and Retreat in 1964, Castle Keep in 1969, and Operation Snafu in 1970. So not a great many war movie roles for him. But
some
I
good
think
ones, though. Castle Keep's an interesting one. We should do that.
It is. Soon. We definitely need to cover it because, I mean, there's a whole load in this week's cast that was like, oh, we need to cover that. Oh, we need to cover that. As I mentioned earlier, he was very aware of not wanting to be typecast, which is kind of ironic that he would come to be known for such an iconic role as Columbo, and that really did typecast him, and he was happy in that role.
What you want to be typecast as, you know?
Yeah, perhaps so. Then we got Robert Ryan giving it a full day's work with the role of Lieutenant General Carson. He's in it for all of like two scenes. One of them is my favorite.
Picking up his check.
There's one where he's like on a giving a press briefing as they board the ships before they head to begin the landings, which is a nice little scene.
He looks like he's still in the costume that he was wearing in Battle of the Bulge, like even down to like the neckerchief. Like, it's really a weird. Go and see him in Battle of the Bulge. Look up a photo, then look up a photo.
It's like the costume designer was just like, screw it, we'll just put him exactly in that.
Maybe it was the same guy. They just had the same costume. Could have been. Like, that's an easy day. Don't have to have a fitting.
Ryan's roles include Behind the Rising Sun in 1943, The Iron Major in the same year, Marine Raiders in 1944, Flying Leathernecks in 1951, Men in War, 1957. I think we've covered that one. Men in War. Gavin in The Longest Day, of course, 1962.
Yes.
Battle of the Bulge in 65, Dirty Dozen in 67, Custer of the West, same year, Anzio, 68, and The Wild Bunch in 1969.
Is he US Percy Herbert, the amount of war films he's in?
Kind of is. And of course, The Professionals, which, you know,
yeah,
he was underused in.
Massively, yeah. He was old by that point.
Yeah. Well, he's only
he's
only
older
like two years older.
Yeah, hang on. He seems older in that, though. Because it was,
I think they try and make his character feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. I think the quality of the film I watched this week was worse than this one. Like, my DVD of it isn't great quality. So
really?
Then
we've got Earl Holliman as Sergeant Abe Stimler. And he was in Destination Gobi in 53, Bridges of Toko Rii, Armored Command in 1961, and lots of westerns. Very recognizable face if you've ever watched a western.
Yeah, very. I was trying to place him forever, and I went on the IMDb. I was like, oh, I've seen that western.
We need to do some military-focused westerns, I think.
There's enough of them. Yeah.
There's a ton, and there's some great ones as well. We've got Mark Damon as Private Wally Richardson. He was in Screaming Eagles in 1956, Longest Day in 62. Shortest Day in 1963, another Italian
That's a funny
production.
One. Yeah.
And then, perhaps most influentially, he was quite a prominent producer, producing Bat 21, Stalingrad 1993.
Wow.
Das Boot, Lone Survivor, and The Last Full Measure. So he was either producer or executive producer on a lot of those movies.
What a career turner. That's incredible.
Yeah, wow. Some really influential stuff.
Yeah.
Then we've got Arthur Kennedy as Major Jack Leslie, who's pretty much definitely based on Major General Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
He was a four-time Oscar nominee.
He
was in They Died With Their Boots on the Air Force in 1943 and had a role in Lawrence of Arabia as well. He brings glints of that Oscar capability.
Yeah,
but
does.
He's not got a lot of what he's doing is exposition.
Isn't there really, true. And you can tell from Falk, I think, was from what you want to know about the script, from Falk's diet, from Falk's biography, it's not as strong as it could be. And then when it wants to try and be stronger, it kind of can't do it. Like the end speech is a little bit hackneyed and like cliche, but yet he contradicts himself right at the end when he says about like men enjoy killing, but then like, oh, but they don't. And I'm like, what? It's confusing. I'm like, what do you actually mean here, Robert? Like, you were shooting someone like 2 seconds ago. And I'll do it again. I'll kill again. Like, I was like, what are you trying to say, Robert? Like, you're a war correspondent.
Arthur Kennedy's there like, what's going on?
What's this bloke going on about?
Anyway,
that man,
the character has just spent 4 months losing, you know, the initiative in Anzio. He's had all the things to think about between the point when he had that conversation with Robert Mitchum on the boat before they landed.
Bloke wants a cup of tea, a cigarette, and quietly scuttled back to America.
We've got Wolfgang Preiss as General Field Marshal Albert Kesselring. He has a list of war movie credits, which I would happily cover every single one of them, because there's some really fascinating stuff in there.
Do it then. We hear the listenership cry.
So we got Canaris 1954, The Plot to Assassinate Hitler in 55, The Green Devils at Monte Cassino in 58. That's the German Falschgram Jäger movie, Monte Cassino. Stalingrad, Dogs, Do You Want to Live Forever, 1959, an early Stalingrad movie. An early German Stalingrad movie. Lafayette, an early American Revolution movie, 1961. Longest Day, The Train, Von Ryan's Express, Is Paris Burning, The Battle of the Commandos, Raid on Rommel, where he plays Rommel. The Standard, which sounds like a really interesting movie. It's about the end of the First World War, where there's a unit of Austrian cavalry that don't want to surrender their standard, their flag. So they, you know, they refuse to surrender and go all the way back to Vienna and ceremonially burn their flag.
Wow, that sounds good.
Yeah, sounds interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then, of course, A Bridge Too Far as well in 1977. So
yeah,
he has an absolutely fascinating...
He's really good in this, by the way. Like
he is.
The scene he's in is one of the most interesting.
The two scenes that we get of him, he's great. Like
really good.
Before we finish, I've got to mention that the two appearances of Brits in there that are kind of shoehorned in there. We've got Anthony Steele as Major General Marsh. He's a veteran, served with the Guards and the Paras during the war. Finished the war as a major. He was in The Wooden Horse in 1950, The Planter's Wife in 1952.
Albert Malaya Barren. Films this week, guys. Christ.
I know. Is that Malaya?
Malaya.
Is it? Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I'm thinking of the other one that that's got the and you know the one I'm thinking of.
It's just Hawkins on a brain. Can't wait to do it.
Yeah. The Sea Shall Not Have Them in 54, Storm Over the Nile in 55, The Black Tent in 56, and Massacre in Rome in 1973, and then the other very recognizable Brit character actor that's next to him in all of those sequences that they're in is Patrick McGee, who plays Major General Starkey, and he was in A Prize of Arms with Stanley Baker.
Yes, need to watch that.
He was also Sergeant Reynolds in Zulu.
Oh, okay, that's where his face was familiar. Yeah.
Cromwell 1970, Young Winston 1972, and Barry Lyndon 1975. And he went with Kubrick on a number of occasions.
For a minute, my brain went... Barry Bannon, the Sheffield Wednesday midfielder. I was like, hasn't had a film made about him. I was like, not yet. Oh, that's staying in. My brain was like, Barry Bannon. Like this little voice in the back of my head was like, Bannon! And I was like, no, it's not right. Jesus Christ. Let's get on to the Ali Tally before we disrail.
We need to stop recording at 11 o'clock at night.
Don't tell him, Matt. Don't tell him.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's time for Ally Tally on Fighting on Film.
So, Ally Tally, Matt, kick us off.
Yanks with SMLEs, we've already mentioned, but let's not forget about those Germans in those haystacks with those BARs and Brens.
I love that. I absolutely adored that.
Hated it. Hated it.
Oh, so it was like something out of a Western. It was brilliant.
So fucking stupid.
It was like something out of the Green Berets. I was expecting to be like BC or something. Like it was so... I love the sort of like whip transitions, the close-ups. It was really Western-y. I love it.
Why do all of the GIs run straight at the machine guns?
It's bizarre, isn't it?
Had anyone ever watched a war movie? Anyone ever like... vaguely had any military experience.
Dimitri's just going insane about them rubber guns. He's had enough at this point, I think.
Just running straight for them.
It's fantastic. Like,
if you know, give me a fiver for every time that shot of four dudes running towards a haystack with a machine gun in it was played.
Like, drink every time someone runs at a firearm in this movie. Oh, you'll be God. Drunk before the
is this film supposed to tell the story of Anzio? Mark. And the landings, and then the Battle of Cisterna, basically.
That's it.
Which,
yeah, that's it.
You know, Cisterna was obviously a massacre for the Rangers.
Yeah.
And that's what that sequence is depicting. And you know what? Have you ever seen Derby's Rangers from like 58?
Rings a bell. Oh, yeah.
What's
yeah,
his
yeah,
name?
Yeah, yeah.
Forget the actor. It'll come back to me. Nope, gone. But basically, that tells much of the same story. And kind of does the scene a bit better, to be honest, than it's
right,
in a studio.
Okay.
I just thought it was ludicrous the way that they ran towards those
it was
guns.
A bit pantomime.
The way that they were like walking along and like, oh, we're really going to catch these Germans on the hop, and then there's like a whip transition to a fucking haystack, and
oh,
it just falls forward. And then a dude pops
like,
up with a brand
gun. It's like when Anderson does a sequence.
Oh, my God. Honestly,
transition.
Can we recut that and put like some Wes Anderson music over it?
In the Darjeeling Limited, just cuts Rowan Wilson to a machine gun haystack. That's fantastic.
What
but
else
no, I know
was
what
in
you
there?
Mean, though. It was fun. Like, I thought that was fun. SMLEs,
yeah.
The Law. Like, again, I think mm-hmm. Law every week, but it's the way of doing it. But yeah, that must have been a... I found you loads of SMLEs to use. Yeah. It's not as jarring though, because when it cuts to the smaller group of men, they've all got in one grand, so you don't really notice.
They do.
Really.
They do have grands, which is good. It's not like that great movie I watched the other week, Operation Overlord.
Oh, Matt, yeah, crikey, it's not as bad as that. No, but then talking about SMLEs, the British troops look good when you see them. They're in their leather jerkins. They got their Battle Order 37 pattern.
There's some nice inclusion of units in there.
I wish they'd turned up again, because the British did land at Anzio and they're kind of written out of that a little bit. That's one of the film's failings for me.
Well, you've we're too busy following Robert Mitchum into a quarry.
I know they didn't land on the same like beaches and whatever, like, you know, mixed together. But like, you could have had a little sequence of showing the British troops getting into landing craft at least. Like, do that. Yeah. You've got the guys on hand. Anyway, one thing that I did enjoy, Peter Falk has proper Thompson webbing. He's got a web, like a Thompson pouch for extra ammunition, extra magazines. Okay. That's nice, because usually in these types of films, you just get a belt or a rifle belt. Nice little attention to detail there. And then again, for the uniform people, Buffs Among Us, there's a nice mixture of M41 jackets, which is sort of like the the norm. Not it's not a jacket with extra pockets. Basically, it's like just like a plain jacket. And their replacement, the M43 uniforms, which were actually trialled in Italy. So that's not completely wrong for them to have those kind of uniforms. I don't know if they were issued en masse to the Rangers or the US in Italy. I think they might have been in small batches for testing. But it's not wrong. So I quite liked it. And then I just love the trope of pattern tanks being used for Shermans and Panzers. Classic. I absolutely love it. Classic trope. Classic. Love it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. One of the things I did like was the inclusion of the Brits and the march past, and I think some Canadians as well, perhaps. And then Falk Rabanov character is from the first Special Service force, yeah, which is the US Canadian sort of kind of special forces unit that was formed. And a film focusing on Rangers is interesting. But of course, obviously, Derby's Rangers had done it a little bit before as well. But yeah, there's not a lot of Ali stuff in here.
Yeah. The sniper rifles are cool.
Oh, yeah. They're like civilian hunting rifles that are cool, that end sequence. My God. Oh.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. There is that sequence. And then the snipers have like a weird tunic on where they've got like camouflage.
It's painted. And I think it's painted on.
The epaulettes,
yeah,
which haven't been painted, and
they've kind of gone so far enough
completely negate any
camouflage
that they're wearing.
That scene confuses me every time I see it because I forget there's more than one sniper because they look so identical, those guys.
I think someone did mention the sniper twins,
twins
on Twitter.
It's funny. They had like 10 snipers in that sequence, but they don't seem it. Like, it's weird.
But that's probably because there was only one dude, and they just like
had they got their money's worth out of him. The poor
guy. They really did.
The Germans are classic Feldgrau Germans as well. Yeah. Like proper 60s, 50s. I think this is Gewehr 98,
like long Gewehr 98s in there, rather than K98K.
There's some local blitzes that get blown up near the end. That's nice. That's the German Bedford, essentially.
Basically.
Yeah, this is good. The Alitalia's good this week. There's nothing I could really complain
there's
about.
There's a couple of scout cars.
Yeah,
as well. So Greyhound in the sequences. Yeah. There's some aerial stuff. I think there might be a Mustang or
something like that. Maybe a Yak. I'm not sure.
You see the underneath of it, and that's about it. Like when it's strafe stuff.
Before we continue, there's actually a nice little thing that they do. I mean, if you don't know, you don't know, but if you know, you know. Much like the jacket chat I just did there, the depiction of Allied war correspondents is quite good in terms of uniform. So you'll see that Robert Mitchum has his US war correspondent Flash, and there were all different types of variations of those. Some were made, personally made by correspondents. Some were issued. He has what seems to be a non-regulation one, but that was common. People did make their own versions. The British correspondent has the British correspondent insignia on his hat, which is like a big C. You can always tell if someone's BBC or someone's British, they have the big C. US have black and yellow insignia. Over lockdown, I became a bit of a war correspondent uniform buff.
You did, yes.
And I spent like £50 on a really rare book full of their insignia. went a bit stir crazy during lockdown. But no, really, really interesting. They're all looking like they should. They're wearing officers like dress, Mitchum's wearing more sort of enlisted man uniform, but that wasn't uncommon for war correspondents to wear the uniform of the men they were embedded with. You'll see the famous photo of Chester Wilmot reporting from Arnhem. Or during the battle for Arnhem, he's wearing a Denison smock, things like that. You know, you see Stanley Maxted wearing a Denison smock in the famous photo of him and Guy Byam when they came back from Arnhem with the midget recordings underneath their battle dress. So I really like the depiction of the war correspondents this week, and I think that's probably one of the strongest thing the film does. And he's treated like an officer, which is a nice little inclusion because they did have officers. They were essentially civilians, but they were treated like officers. There's a nice bit where...
mentioned that before, yeah.
Mitchum's looking to go off in a Jeep.
After a Jeep, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's like, get this man a Jeep and a man. That's very common. You just
drives off into Rome.
Do what you want. Yeah. Really good.
Minutes the film.
The only better depiction of a war correspondent in war films for me is Burgess Meredith. We mentioned him at the top of the show as Only Pyle. But, you know.
We should do a war correspondent roundup ep where we talk about.
We could.
Any pile, Burgess Meredith.
Even the works that they wrote themselves that were turned into films. You've got Richard Tresidas, yeah. Guadalcanal Diary. Obviously, mm-hmm. this film is one of Vaughan Thomas's film. So,
yeah
there's definitely something in there. Good stuff.
Moving on.
Nice. Favourite scenes? Shall I kick us off for favourite scenes?
Yeah.
Right, the beach landing. It's grand. There's loads of troops. There's LCTs. There's ships.
Half decent bit of model work going on.
Quite good. Yeah. You get the lads on the ships looking over. Mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of stock footage from something being used for the aerial bomb. The naval bombardment sequence. Couldn't quite work out what it was.
Know. There's a lot of rockets and bits and bobs, isn't there?
You know. I wondered if it was colorized footage from Normandy or Salerno, because there is some good footage. There's a couple of big, what's it blooming called? The Big Picture. It's a couple of those documentaries that were made in the 40s that sometimes they nick footage from. It gives really good scale. There's landing craft tanks, unloading patterns, which is nice to see.
There is, yeah.
As I say, that is quite strong. I think that whole sequence of setting up the invasion, showing the amount of troops that are being loaded onto ships, starts off really well, and you see it, and you see the tanks moving in at the headquarters where we meet the British commanders. That's nice, but then after that, I think the film falls. The film starts to get, as I say, most times if I don't like the way a film's going, the film gets muddled. After that sequence.
Yeah, no, I agree. For me, my favourite scene is, it harkens back to the beginning of the show where we talked about that big set piece in Rome of where they had all the soldiers on.
Really good. I just wish it had been in it more.
My favourite part of that is where Robert Ryan is sat in the Jeep and he gets hit in the face by a bouquet of flowers and he laughs it off. It's the best part.
I'm really angry about that after.
He just hands
2 days on this picture and I was hit in the face by a bouquet of flowers.
there's a little setup for it as well where there's like a staff officer hands a little bouquet of flowers to someone, I think it's a woman, and like pushes her forward to like throw them. And she throws them. And it's like there's like a sharp cut and it's just like Robert Ryan getting hit in the face from the completely different side.
Yeah.
Completely different, like she throws it from the left, he gets hit from the right in the face by this bouquet.
Classic edit there. Like,
he's just like, what? And he just kind of like smirks and laughs it off.
Yeah.
Well, that's my favourite scene.
Oh, fair enough. That's quite a quick one this week. Yeah. That's, as I say, I think the main bulk of our issues will come in Final Thoughts, and that's coming right now. Film of three acts, isn't it?
Mm.
So clear. That we've done for a while. Like, the movie doesn't flow very well. You definitely tell when they've done their big budget pieces because that's all you get. So, as I've written it here, the invasion, the Battle of Sinester, and behind enemy lines, it's a sliding scale of quality. Have you seen that? Yeah. Seen that sketch on Family Guy where it goes, look, it's the Disney Stock Exchange ride, and it's that graph going down. That's a very random reference there. But if it was a graph, it starts quite high and it ends quite low.
It's tonally, this film's weird. It's just weird all the way through. So it begins with like a 60s lounge pop song. With Robert Mitchum walking through US headquarters in, I'm guessing, somewhere in southern Italy.
Yeah.
It's insane. Might have been Sicily. Yeah. It's so ill-fitting. It's wild. Honestly, it just does not fit at all. And then the next bit is like that chandelier sequence where there's a dude swinging a chandelier. Apparently, he had two vertebrae dislodged. Someone threw a full can of beer at him. Like, all the extras were told not to throw full cans. And someone threw a full can. and it dislodged two vertebrae in his neck.
Someone just eating a beer at that poor chap.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's hilarious.
Because
in that scene, people are throwing things quite hard.
They are.
That's hilarious.
You know, and to his credit, he finishes the scene.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he holds on. He beats the records.
Falk's entrance is quite nice.
Yeah,
it's quite
good,
like that
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. He's good. He's the standout in this, really, isn't he?
Starts a big fight. Oh yeah, of course he is. I mean, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I just really did not enjoy this film. I'm going to say
Matt's like me. Matt's like me last week with Blood and Gold. If you listened, go back if you didn't. But yeah, we were on opposing sides. I don't hate this. I think it has redeeming qualities.
Oh, I do.
I kind of like it in a weird way, because I like it how that it's essentially a big budget spaghetti war film with the big American stars. I kind of like how it's that, and it has there's something about it that I can't hate it.
There's something about it I can't like it. Like it's just. It's so mid. It's
opposite.
Because it goes from that introduction, and then we get that quite nice set piece with the beach and the landings, and the getting on the LCTs, and the getting on the landing ships, and then they're getting ready to get on the transport off the transports into the landing craft, and they go ashore, and it's great. And you think, oh, okay, cool, we're gonna get some nice set pieces.
I forgot about the bit with the mines thrown in the tiles.
Oh right, well let me refresh your memory about that. They would have been completely fine walking through that field because they were anti-tank mines.
Sorry. Should have put this up in the alley tally, mate.
Yeah, I know. I can't mention it now. I didn't mention it earlier.
You're not allowed now. The rivet counter o'clock here. You're not allowed. That's his section.
So, yeah, I hate that bit. I just hate it so much. Like, I hated the set piece.
And then they skip through the fucking minefield.
Jesus.
Like ballet. It's like so.
By the time they get to the middle of it, he's like literally just sort of like slightly stooping when he's throwing them. And the tile he throws gets completely obliterated.
Minefield sequence is like the standard for doing minefield sequences.
Yeah.
For tension at least. There's no tension in that scene.
We should do a
about the flamethrower tank as well. That's cool.
That was okay, wasn't it? Let me outline how dysfunctional this film in sort of tone is.
I just remember Matt live messaging me. I was trying to go to bed and he was messaging me, being like, Rob, I don't like it. It's too long.
That's normally your line.
Why did you choose this? I was like, because you've got to have a varied choice for the Patreons.
Oh, God. So it starts with, obviously, what we've just discussed, Chandelier.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Awful pop song. Then we get a big set piece landing. Great. Then we get a terrible battle where fucking haystacks fall apart and men pop out of them. Cartoon shit. Have you seen Stop That Tank? Watch the Disney film Stop That Tank made about the boys' anti-tank rifle by Disney for the Canadian Army. One dude is in a
That's an insane reference off the top of the dome. That's fantastic.
But it is. We get a terrible like minefield sequence where Mitchum takes command, and then what happens then? Like,
I just don't care for Mitchum.
Where it becomes Guns of Navarone, where they like find the Gothic line or whatever it is they're building,
and they
go off and scout that out. He gets lost and goes to sleep in a fucking barbed wire.
I think it's the Gustav line you're actually thinking of.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
so
sorry.
Yes, he falls asleep, wakes up, and then some German guy's like dog is nudging him, and he leads him out of the barbed wire maze, which is that's nice and stuff. Character gets killed, and then we get like this weird bit where they're in a crater filled quarry.
Quarry count number two weeks in a row. Three weeks. I don't know.
Smash cut half the cast that we've been with the whole film is dead.
They just pick them off really quick. Like the only guy that gets like an honourable death is I forget who he is, because the guys that aren't Falcor Mitrim are a bit interchangeable, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Character-wise, not actor-wise, but like characterization, there's just not enough of them. Not enough going on. But the guy that gets shoots the German officer sentry to help Mitrim get away.
Yeah.
And then he's being searched and he takes the boy's picture.
Yeah, I think that's Richardson. Mark Damon. I think that's him.
And he fights him for the picture, and that's really quite powerful. Actually, I wasn't expecting
that's
that.
That's a nice little sequence.
Well done sequence. You got the
but it's ruined by the fact that it's got Robert Mitchum like watching him from the tree line, being like,
not helping him.
Yeah, we can't do anything. He hasn't got a weapon, but he's just like watching. Just watching, like, oh yeah, I'll have to write about that later, won't I?
Mitrim is the person in this movie. He's just looking at him going, this will make a good story. I'm like, you're a fucking hack, Robert. You're an absolute hack.
Yeah, he never makes any notes.
No, it's all in there. It's all up there, isn't it? Yeah.
And then there's that bit in the house where they probably get that entire Italian family murdered, because then they ambush some German soldiers that come in.
Falk gets a good death, because he actually has blood like spurt out of his chest, which
he does.
Was nice.
He does, and Falk is probably the only person in this film that has any character development, because they set him up as a rambunctious NCO corporal. He wrote that scene where he's in the back of the truck.
That was funny,
where he's like paying off his two whores that he's been pimping out money off.
In the Dodge ambulance. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Then later on, he has that sequence in the farmhouse where he has the attack of the shrapnel that's still in his gut, which was quite nice.
From the Japanese front, yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember exactly where he was.
The Pacific Theatre, not the fucking Japanese front. What am I talking about?
People know. They know what you're talking about, Rob.
I thought that was cool, because I was like, that makes no sense, but I love it. Like, I just think what he was saying, I was like, what?
He's straight up again.
Stomach.
He's like, no, I'm fine. Let's carry on singing Bye Bye Blackbird.
Because I like the duality of Falk being like, oh, it's cliched, and I wanted to rewrite and I didn't like it, yet the character he comes up with is horrendously cliched at times. Like, I just love it. Like, there's something about it.
In Falk's words, he says, Anzio is not my best example of good acting. While I enjoyed my time in Italy, I felt my career was no longer presenting me with acting challenges.
Okay. I think he's all right. He's the redeeming quality out of this. Yeah. And my biggest gripe is that you don't see the British enough, which I think is a missed opportunity, because it's called Anzio.
The only time you see the British is where they're exposition merchants, where they turn up to go, well, sir, we really should be pushing out of the beachhead, should we not? Should we not be advancing? And the American general's like, no, we're good.
Nah. I'm too cool. It just gives it the whole, I'm too cool for school, then overly cautious,
Patrick McGee's there, like, chewing the scenery, like, can we please advance?
Let's do something. Yeah, exactly.
Film where the Brits are right. Telling Americans what to do.
Come on.
Gotta be said.
Get the fucking lead out, boys. Come on.
Yeah.
Them patterns, just get them patterns rolling, boys. To cut a long story short this week, I like it for the wrong reasons. So I understand that it is a flawed picture, not a lot going on for it. Kind of wish that Mitrim had been British to ode to the original writer. Of the source material, I think it would have been an interesting, more
nice
of an
little
interesting
role for Stanley Baker there.
Oh, that'd be good, wouldn't it? Or or David Niven, perhaps.
Or Niven, yeah.
Niven, anyone?
Yeah. Or Harry
anyone.
Andrews, actually.
Harry
Andrews could have done that.
Andrews would have been a good portrayal, especially at that time. So yeah, I think it might have some of that ending sort of thing about the duality of
it's
doing. Very,
it's so that. Let me just cap off my diatribe about this film. Before we talk about the end sequence where he has a chat with the general, like, so we get the weird sniper sequence, which is like in a contextual landscape of Zero. It's a quarry with some craters in it, and they're running around and people get shot and Falk dies.
Yeah,
and then It's supposed to be this big, impactful sequence where Mitchum finally picks up a gun and has to like fight and kill a German. Because the whole push throughout the film has been he's on a quest to find out why men fight. We'll talk about the payoff for that in a moment. But after that, you kind of get this weird wrap up segment where it goes, where it shows a completely disjointed, very flat combat sequence of US forces breaking through that defensive line that they discovered was being built.
Yeah.
And then
It's too quick.
And then there's no characters that we've been with.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah, it's
1 hour 50.
It's just so
in that sequence.
It feels an afterthought. It's like second unit shit, you know?
Yeah, oh totally second unit stuff. Yeah. And then you get the march through Rome. And then the little sequence with the general and the little sequence with the sergeant and Mitchum walking off into the sunset. And it's just doesn't work for me.
And that's what I mean. I like it for the wrong reasons. Like any real movie worth its salt would have ended on Mitchum's chat with the general. And it would have been like, the general's to blame here, cut, end. But you get this extra, although the Rome sequence is cool, it's tacked on. As I said, flawed film, but I like it for all the wrong reasons. And I'm really pleased the Patreons chose it because, you know, I thought you
first
said one
the
would
chat with the general tries to wrap up that whole question of why do we fight? And as we mentioned earlier,
it's too convoluted, really.
It really is. And Mitchum basically says we fight because we like to. And the general's like, we like to, do we? And Mitchum's like, yep. Mitchum's just like, yep, we like to fight. I'll kill again. I'm like, okay.
Oh,
I will kill again.
You know in the Punisher when he's in Deadpool and he's in the dock and he's like, I'll do it again. And I liked it. That's, Mitchum's doing that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's it. A review of two conflicting opinions again this week. We did it last week. Finally not seeing eye to eye on these films. It's taken a while because usually... When we like something, we're both pretty in tune. But interesting, Anzio and Blood and Gold were the films that we...
Oh, Blood and Gold is a much more entertaining film than Anzio. I've got to say it now.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. My God, stratosphere right there.
Fair enough. Well, there you go. The duality, much like Robert Mitchum's speech at the end of Anzio, the duality of man reflected in our review here today. Mm-hmm. So thanks for joining us yet again for another war movie review. Coming up on the show, if you've listened this long, a little treat, we will be talking again to the fantastic Duane Epstein about his recent book, Killing Generals, all about the making of The Dirty Dozen. Me and Matt listened to it on a very long drive. On audio book, and I think Matt, what a great book. We're really looking forward to talking about that one because he mentioned it when we reviewed The Dirty Dozen back in December.
He was working on it when we had him on last time as well.
Great book, guys. If you haven't listened to it, please go and get a copy. We'll be chatting to him soon on the show, so look out for that. And do join us again next week for another war movie review. Check out the website, fightingonfilm.com, leave us a review, and we'll catch you again. Thanks for listening.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.